Previously on the Great James Bond Car Robbery.
Goldfinger. Goldfinger.
It just cracked me up. I called this one of the most boneheaded moves in all of autodom.
These three British companies were absolutely at each other's throats to get your pocket money.
I'd left my passenger window open and some lady leapt through the window into his lap.
They're making a toy that's going to be played with to destruction. That's the point.
And these guys in their sports cars would go nuts.
Welcome to The Great James Bond Car Robbery with me, Elizabeth Hurley. Episode 7, Voicemail or Blackmail? So, we're about halfway through the factory tour when this happens.
I've just got to go grab my gun. I'm just going to do it with the 9mm.
A 9mm semi-automatic. This is happening at a rather unusual workshop in rural Utah, by the way. We're being given a remote walkabout of the facility.
And so, again, like I said, we have neighbors in this complex. And I used to be able to do it really pretty easily in other places, but they've got a little bit more complaining.
Down the line, I can hear our host is locking and loading.
And this makes me nervous, so I shake a little more than I usually do.
He's Mark Burton, CEO and founder of ArmorMax.
Okay, you ready?
The world's premier suppliers of armor-plated and defensive weapon-equipped cars.
Okay, I'm gonna shoot.
All righty, go for it.
I'm going to shoot again. I can't see my target right now because it's all smoky inside, but I know where it's at.
In this episode, we'll be finding out if it's possible to build a real-life, fully functional Bond gadget car. Bulletproofing, smoke screens, machine guns, the lot. Something Q would be proud of. And our mission to locate the original Bond gadget car continues. We'll be exploring how an anonymous voicemail message left with Boca Raton police raises the question, could the theft of the Goldfinger DB5 be an inside job all along?
Hey, Derek, they can continue working. Okay, thank you. Right now, I shot 3 rounds, and from the front side, you can feel them.
Now the smoke's cleared, he's holding up a sample plate of ArmorMax B4-rated bulletproof glass.
Okay, they're absorbed inside the material, okay? And the backside, it's just a little bit lumpy, okay? But they didn't go through, okay? So they're stuck in there. In fact, they're still hot. I can touch them and they're hot in the material.
A cobweb of fine shatter circles surrounds the flattened 9mm rounds held in place in the glass. If you're the kind of person that people might want to shoot at, this is what you want in your windshield.
This is our very lightweight material. This is our handgun. I'm not going to shoot a high-powered rifle in here, but I just shot a handgun.
Mark's team specialize in taking civilian vehicles, albeit very high-end civilian vehicles, and subtly transforming them into impregnable, gadget-filled fortresses against enemy attack.
We've done vehicles for 47 different heads of state around the world. We've done them for probably half of the 20 wealthiest people in the world. For example, I designed a number of the Popemobiles and built them.
The South Korean military also uses products.
You know the radomes, the round balls that are over the radar dishes? Well, we armored 7 of those in the DMZ between North Korea and South Korea.
What could be more Bond than an armored glass radar dish to protect against North Korean attack?
You know, so we're recognized in those circles.
In episode 5, we learned that it is possible to buy your very own perfect replica Goldfinger DB5, complete with Q's gadgets, if you have several $1 million to spare or access to Aston Martin's factory. But for all their beauty, those clone DB5s were really collector's pieces. Mark's workshop here in Utah offers something altogether more practical. He says the first step in building a protective vehicle is to know the environment it'll be used in, the threats you will encounter. Starting with the bulletproofing.
So it depends on the threat level, okay? For example, here in the U.S., the big market is for handgun protection, which is called a B4, B as in boy, 4. And that'll stop up and through a 44 Magnum. That's 1,450 feet per second.
Other environments require something more heavy duty. Conflict zones, for example.
You go up to the high-powered rifle and it starts at 42 millimeters thick. If you go to a head of state car, you get up to 78 millimeters thickness. So it becomes much more to stop armor-piercing rounds. And we do that. In fact, we have a contract right now for 140 vehicles. It'll stop just about anything you can bring to your shoulder. That's referred to as a B as in boy, 7.
Bulletproofing is the most popular service that Mark offers. But of course, in the movies, Bond's cars are famous for more outlandish gadgets, such as...
Oh, yeah. We have multiple cars here right now that we're doing the smokescreen with. We have a liquid that we've developed that you basically burn through your exhaust system. And when you hit the switch, it creates a tremendous amount of smoke behind your car. And basically, you're able to escape behind that cloud. And so that's a very popular one. It's about $1,250 option. I would say probably now about 50% of the clients are buying that option.
How about strengthened bumpers for ramming enemies? A Ken Adams special.
Most of these cars have that option on them because they're concealed. They're behind the original bumper.
Machine guns.
For example, on the machine guns, we have done, and I won't tell you what we did it on. It was for a government agency. This isn't as, can I use the word sexy, as the DB5, okay? But we did these pickup trucks and we put the toolbox in the bed of the truck. And then we installed machine guns in that toolbox in the back. So the toolbox opens at the top and the machine gun comes up out of the box, the toolbox. It looks like a normal civilian pickup truck. And then the machine gun comes up out of the back and you control it with joysticks in the cab, right? And you have cameras. So it's really a special ops vehicle that has weaponry.
Of course, finally, the legendary DB5 ejector seat. Possible?
Yes, it is. We've never done one. We've done seats that raise up. For example, for some Saudi princes, they love to falcon hunt. And so we built these bench seats in the back that were hydraulically elevated. And actually, we have a verbal confirmation on 6 units right now where they stand on a platform and it raises up so that they can get in a more offensive mode. It's for security teams of a third world head of state.
But ultimately, Mark says it's not the complicated gadgets in his vehicle that'll keep you safe.
We've had over 300 attacks on our vehicles, and we've talked to a lot of those people, okay, that have been attacked. And if there's somebody standing in front of them shooting at them, we don't want them flipping all these switches and being, you know, excuse the expression, but James Bond, you know, in this, because they're not trained to do that. And so we just say, if they're in front of you, run them over. If they're shooting at you, run them over. Just get out of there. And that's what these cars are really designed to do. They're not designed to stand there and fight because they're defensive in nature.
What we know is this. The message was left as a voicemail.
Hi, this is Officer Croy. I'm away from my desk right now. Please leave a message after the tone.
With Police Officer Croy of the Boca Raton Police Department on July 12, 1997.
Well, I guess I've got some information that you should be aware of.
A full transcription of the message wasn't added to the official police report into the theft of the DB5. So all of this is a reconstruction closely based on notes taken by the lead investigating police officer. Officer Schnackenberg.
I'm not going to leave my name, but that James Bond car, it wasn't stolen. It was moved to Newark, a warehouse up there.
At this stage, it's just under a month since the burglary at Boca Raton Airport. Schnackenberg and the rest of the team have now filed 19 pages of meticulous notes, but so far, no arrests. And this is the first mention of warehouses in Newark.
Yeah, and you know the guy who took it there? It was Anthony Puglisi. He's got a warehouse up there. Anthony Puglisi.
Yes, the owner of the car. The man who purchased it at auction in the 80s. The man who allowed it to be displayed in museums across America. The man who had it insured for $4.2 million. The victim of the crime.
He himself has had the car stolen for insurance purposes. So, yeah, that's what I've got to say.
Remember Theory 1? Exit by cargo plane? And Theory 2, the flatbed tow truck getaway. Well, Theory 3 is different. It doesn't require a break-in by cat burglars, tires being dragged across tarmac, or a cargo plane landing in the dead of night. At the time that voicemail is received, Boca Raton PD are pursuing a number of leads in the case, none of which appear to be on the verge of a breakthrough. Officer Schnackenberg wrote most of this section of the police report. His written notes from the weeks before the voicemail give a flavor of where things are. His words are read by an actor.
On June 23rd, I received a message that the sheriff's report had not been forwarded to records yet. They would fax it when it arrived. July 3rd, I spoke with Mr. Puglisi and advised him of the status of the case. I again asked him if he had any suspects in the case, and he advised that he knew nobody who would do something like this. I called James Bond's number again on June 26th. Again, there was no answer.
That last isn't a joke. The team really are trying to contact James Bond. James A. Bond, that is, married to Marilyn D. Bond of Palm City, Florida. Date of birth? September 9th, 1933. This Mr. Bond had an interest in novelty 007 car license plates, which meant he'd been placed on the list of people to be contacted by the police. Unsurprisingly, he knew nothing about the case. There is also an investigation undertaken into some half-remembered suspicious activity near the DB5 when it was exhibited at Delray Beach in Florida. A number of individuals acting strangely around the car. Could they have been scoping out a target? But again, frustratingly, no convincing leads emerge. So the anonymous voicemail has the potential to change everything. Officer Bill Schnackenberg is now retired and declined to be interviewed for this podcast, saying he has no independent recollection or comments regarding the case other than what is found in my original reports which were generated at the time. We also requested an interview with Anthony Puglisi. He too chose not to speak to us. But there are a number of reasons why the police might have considered the voicemail to be worthy of further investigation. First, alleged motive. Schnackenberg and the other investigating officers were aware that the DB5 was insured and that Puglisi stood to benefit from a substantial payout if the theft was found to be covered by the policy. In the weeks leading up to the tip-off, Schnackenberg records having met with insurance investigator Art Chalikian, sent to Boca Raton to assess the theft on behalf of the insurance company. Chalikian agrees to share his findings with Boca Raton police. We don't know if Boca Raton PD were aware at this stage of how much the insurance payout might be. That Puglisi would receive a payout of up to $4.2 million, or that the car was insured for more than 16 times its purchase price a decade earlier. And as we heard in episode 2, Bill Grundy of Grundy Insurance has been quoted as saying that the $4.2 million appraisal was a mistake, and that the car should have been valued at much less. And that view was broadly confirmed by three other classic car experts we spoke to. In other words, it's easy to understand why the police might think that insurance fraud would be more lucrative than simply reselling the vehicle. As a theory, insurance fraud had another advantage over Grand Theft Auto. The Goldfinger DB5 would not be a particularly easy vehicle for real car thieves to dispose of profitably. As we heard in our Golden Triangle case, a genuine theft is often followed by sales on the black market, laundering into the legitimate car market, or dismantling for parts. All require an extensive network, an underworld infrastructure. and all are much more risky propositions with the most famous car in the world, a car that turns heads, that people remember, that is all over TV, newspapers, and radio.
What do you do with this car?
John Cork, the film producer and founding member of the Ian Fleming Foundation. He says that in general, the DB5 would be a terrible choice for car thieves.
There's nothing you can do with it. It's not like you can put it somewhere and it's going to increase in value. It's one of a kind. It has no external value if you're not selling it legitimately.
Of course, that doesn't mean that someone may not have tried to steal it regardless, or that the car may not have been stolen by someone who didn't realize these problems.
It could have been that the robbers pulled it out, brought it back to whoever wanted them to steal cars, and that person said, "You idiots, this is a one-of-the-kind car. This is complete poison," and they dumped it in a canal somewhere or dumped it off a boat. Who knows?
Before the anonymous call came in, we do know that Schnackenberg was investigating the possibility that the DB5 had entered the black market, that it was now part of that criminal infrastructure. But it was a less than promising lead.
June 23, 1997. I received a Crime Stoppers report indicating that a subject, Redacted, who owns the Redacted Auto Works and Redacted Motor Club in Fort Lauderdale, had been changing vehicle identification numbers on vehicles and then sending them overseas. The complainant advised that he had seen a replica Aston Martin in one of the businesses 10 years ago.
Yes, 10 years ago. A decade-old clue. Schnackenberg still has Fort Lauderdale officers visit that auto works, but no connection to the Goldfinger DB5 emerges. Second, the means to carry out the crime as described in the voicemail. Boca Raton police would have had reason to investigate here too. As the renter of an aircraft hangar, Pugliese of course had access to the airport and would have been aware of the security provisions there and possibly their weaknesses. And the opportunity to dispose of the DB5? This is where the voicemail's most easily verified claim comes in, that Pugliese owned warehouses in New Jersey where the car had allegedly been taken. Once again, none of this, then or now, is proof of the anonymous caller's accusations, but it does explain why the Boca Raton PD investigation took a dramatically new turn after the voicemail was received. In the days following the voicemail, the police report shows a flurry of activity. The insurance fraud division is contacted, and they offer to check whether Pugliese has property in New Jersey. The insurance investigators are also apparently investigating Pugliese's business holdings. Schnackenberg speaks to insurance investigator Art Chalikian.
He is currently running real estate checks on the subject Pugliese and would forward that information to me, probably next week.
This conversation also reveals a new line of inquiry.
He also said that Pugliese is having some of his property being foreclosed on.
From here on, the financial health of Pugliese's other businesses appears to be a new topic of interest for the investigation. Adam Luck, the journalist who's been researching the case for us.
It's clear that Detective Schnackenberg starts doing more checks in relation to Pugliese and his business interests and what his motives might be in relation to this. And then Schnackenberg contacts an agent Thurber of the Division of Insurance Fraud with the Florida Insurance Commission. And they said that they would check out whether Mr. Pugliese had property in Newark.
But after this, the pace of the investigation begins to slow again. Days and then weeks go by, with Schnackenberg still attempting to verify if Pugliese does own warehouses in New Jersey. 18 days after the voicemail accusation.
I spoke with Art Chalikian on July 30th, 1997. He advised that he did not have the information on Pugliese's real estate holdings in New Jersey yet, but would have them shortly. He advised that Pugliese owned many businesses, and it was time-consuming to check these out and see what kind of businesses they were.
20 days after the voicemail.
On August 1st, 1997, I called Newark PD and spoke with Detective Rubello. He advised that they do not have the capabilities to check by name the owner of properties in the city of Newark. He advised that I should contact the tax assessor's office.
Then, nearly a month after the tip-off, a breakthrough.
On August 6th, 1997, I spoke with Art Chalikian.
Turns out, Chalikian has taken a bold new approach to the question of whether Pugliese owns warehouses in New Jersey, actually asking Pugliese himself.
He advised that he had recently spoken with Pugliese, and he had advised that Pugliese had two large 1.2 million square foot warehouses.
It sounds like important progress. A key claim made in the voicemail has been confirmed as accurate. However,
there's nothing in the crime report to suggest that they've actually followed up on this. We have warehouses in which supposedly a 4.2 million car has been shipped to. We have no evidence from the crime report that that warehouse has been visited, which is all the more odd in view of the fact that in the early stages of this crime report, Schnakenberg makes a big play for trying to track down his warehouses through official avenues. And yet, when he learns that Pugliese does indeed have a warehouse and he's admitting it, and he's even giving him the location of it, there's nothing in the crime report to suggest that they've actually followed up on this.
Again, Officer Schnakenberg declined our offer of an interview, so we can't say why these decisions were taken. And again, the investigation report is extremely detailed, recording even brief phone calls. No trip to the Newark warehouse is recorded anywhere. After this point, following the warehouse breakthrough, the report appears to show the investigation slowing still further. Schnakenberg's police report entries from this point begin to be more widely spaced, a week or 10 days between even minor notes, such as a phone call or a conversation about the case. In early September, the insurance investigator Chalikian informs the police that he will soon be taking a formal statement from Pugliese on behalf of the insurers. That's something that the police have yet to do since the appearance of the voicemail accusation. Pugliese's apparent financial troubles are again noted, including the foreclosure on a multi-million dollar property, suggesting that motives for a possible insurance fraud are still being considered. We haven't been able to verify whether these reports were accurate. Schnakenberg also notes, without comment, Pugliese's apparent reluctance to publicize the theft. Apparently, this is based on the wishes of the insurance company.
On September 4th, 1997, I was able to speak with Mr. Pugliese. He advised that he had received a call from Unsolved Mysteries, and he advised that he didn't think it was worthwhile for the case to be put on television. He had also received calls from some magazines, he said, but he was not giving any interviews, per his insurance company's wishes. He advised that he did not have any suspects in mind and had no additional information.
Then, in spite of Pugliese remaining almost the sole subject of the inquiry at this point, and still with no strong evidence to prove or disprove the insurance fraud allegation, the tempo of the investigation starts to slow even further. In fact, it appears to go into hibernation. There follows a gap of 3 months before the next entry in the report, which merely records some activity by the insurance investigators. Then, a further 3 months of silence. Could this be the end of the story? Then, seemingly out of nowhere, 6 months after the existence of the warehouses were confirmed, 8 months after the allegations that the crime is part of an insurance fraud, and 9 months after the disappearance of the car, Boca Raton PD take a major new step.
On March 13th, 1998, myself and Detective Bailey went by Pugliese's office and met with him. Pugliese had his personal attorney, Mr. Frick, sit in with us.
It seems Mr. Pugliese expects this meeting will have a different purpose from the previous friendly conversations. The interview commences.
Mr. Pugliese again denied having any suspects in the theft of his vehicle. He also said that he doesn't know what happened to his vehicle or its current whereabouts. Pugliese denied having any agreement with Robert Luongo to sell the vehicle. I asked Mr. Pugliese if there was anyone who may have a personal grudge against him, and he advised that he didn't know of anyone.
Well, Schnakenberg asks a sort of fairly perfunctory series of questions, and then finally Schnakenberg confronts him with this anonymous tip.
I then advised Mr. Pugliese about the anonymous phone call that was received about the vehicle being kept in a warehouse in Newark, New Jersey.
That he was in on the job, and that it was shuffled off to this New Jersey warehouse. And at that point, Pugliese admits that he has warehouses in New Jersey.
He advised that the building is at 29 Riverside Avenue, Newark, New Jersey. Be advised that the building is owned by the company Industrial Development Associates. Puglesi said that he had no personal storage area at that site.
It is worth noting that Chalikian's research had indicated that Puglesi controlled more than one warehouse in New Jersey.
I asked Mr. Puglesi if he would be willing to take a polygraph in light of the phone call received and the accuracy of that information.
A polygraph, a lie detector test.
His attorney advised that he had heard that they were not reliable and that he didn't see any reason for Puglesi to do anything further, as he had done everything necessary. He declined the request to have Puglesi come in and take the polygraph.
And so, the next step? An interview without a polygraph? A plan to examine the warehouses? Clarification on the insurance history of the car? Well, no.
That seems to be the end of that particular meeting.
3 days later, Schnackenberg attempts to speak to Robert Luongo on the phone. But Luongo says that he needs to consult an attorney first.
And then, effectively, the detective says that's it. He effectively closes the investigation.
At this point, I recommend the case be inactivated, pending further leads or information becoming available.
Once again, both Officer Schnackenberg and Puglesi declined an interview with us, so we cannot be certain why the investigation ended at this stage. We asked Schnackenberg by email why no further inquiries were made in the case after Mr. Puglesi had refused a polygraph and the warehouse details of the tip-off had proved accurate. He did not respond to our written questions. We also wrote repeatedly to Anthony Puglesi to ask whether there was any truth to the accusations made in the anonymous voicemail. He also declined to be interviewed. The insurance investigators also concluded their work on the case too and found that the theft was genuine, that the car was covered by the policy, and that Anthony Puglesi was entitled to a $4.2 million payout. Anthony Puglesi was never charged or convicted of any crime in relation to this case. We were able to speak to one person who is close to Puglesi and is very familiar with his legal affairs.
Well, you all must spend a lot of time editing this stuff, huh?
He's right, we do. This is Greg Coleman again, the lawyer who represented Puglesi in the bitter legal battle with Puglesi's brother-in-law and one-time caretaker of the car, Robert Luongo. As we heard in episode 5, Luongo later won that lawsuit and got a cut of the DB5 insurance money. And you'll remember that Greg's a big fan of Puglesi.
I've known him now for probably close to 25 years. I've represented him. And we also had a friendship and still maintain a friendship to this day.
And Greg Coleman has a very different explanation for the voicemail accusation.
Well, Roberts threatened Anthony and said, look, Anthony, I want 10% of the insurance proceeds, or I am going to go to the insurance company and tell them that you had it stolen.
Blackmail, in other words.
Which was, you know, ridiculous. And you'd have to know Anthony, but in addition to his incredible level of creativity and intelligence and success, he's also a deeply principled man and said, tell him whatever you want to tell him. I didn't do anything. You know that. I know that. And I will not be extorted. I am thinking, you're catching me now, you know, this has been a long time ago, 25 years. I'm thinking we did go to the police and we did file a police report on his blackmail and extortion.
We contacted Boca Raton PD asking to see that police report. They said they were unable to find any report matching that description in their records. In any case, the extortion allegations never went any further, according to Mr. Coleman.
I can tell you in my experience here in Palm Beach County for so many years, the state attorney here, I was an assistant state attorney, I was a prosecutor, so I know how they think. They're not going to waste their time on a couple of guys arguing over money when you have murderers and drug dealers and rapists and really bad people. So they don't ever pursue those. But I do seem to recall that there was a police report filed about that extortion.
Whatever happened to that police report about extortion, Coleman says Robert Luongo's blackmail threats were also behind the anonymous voicemail messages to Boca Raton PD.
We understand through our case that that woman was somehow associated with Robert Luongo. So he followed through on his extortionistic threat, is my understanding.
I would vigorously dispute that.
You probably also remember Jeffrey Fisher, Luongo's lawyer. Robert Luongo died in the early 2000s.
I would dispute everything that Mr. Coleman said in that regard. I represented Robert for years. I never, ever heard him say that Mr. Puglisi had the car stolen. Okay, there were rumors that were circulated to that effect, but it was not from Robert. Robert did not know what happened to the car. Robert wanted to recover the car, you know, even more than the money. But I would categorically deny that Robert would have started such a rumor.
What seems to be clear from the police investigation is this. When questioned by Officer Schnackenberg about the voicemail message, Puglisi does not mention any of this. He does not allege that the anonymous voicemail is connected to extortion threats against him and does not say that the voicemail message is the result of him being blackmailed for insurance money by his former brother-in-law. Officer Schnackenberg also asks Puglisi directly if anyone might have a personal grudge against him, and Puglisi replies that he doesn't know of anyone. Again, for whatever reason, Robert Luongo is not mentioned. And there's another element to the case, the insurance investigation.
You're not talking about, you know, some C-rated insurance company. You're talking about Chubb Insurance Company, which is one of the best in the world, doing as thorough an investigation as any insurance company could have ever done. And if they had thought even for a second that there was a 1% chance that Anthony would have been involved, they would have simply filed a lawsuit and said, you know what, Judge, you decide. So for all of those reasons, that's just not in the realm of realistic possibility in my mind.
In the years since the theft, Anthony Puglisi has continued to be a high-profile figure in Florida.
Palm Beach Post, April 11th, 2019. Developer must pay $23.1 million in failed EcoCity project.
Media coverage has not always been kind.
A failed plan to team up with Subway founder Fred DeLuca to build an EcoCity in Central Florida will cost Delray Beach developer Anthony Puglisi $23.1 million, an appeals court ruled Wednesday.
Puglisi's criminal actions in this highly publicized case, unrelated to the DB5 theft, led to him being jailed for 4 months.
During a 5-week trial in 2017, Puglisi admitted he sent DeLuca $2.9 million in phony invoices. The 72-year-old politically connected developer even told the jury he was convicted of charges of grand theft and conspiracy to commit organized scheme to defraud and served 4 months of a 6-month jail sentence.
Once again, Mr. Puglisi declined to be interviewed for this podcast. Whatever happened to the Aston Martin DB5 in 1997, it is still missing now, and the six-figure reward is still on offer for anyone that can provide information that leads to its return, whatever corner of the world it might have reached. Adam Luck again.
It is possible, of course, that it is in the hands of an oligarch or in the hands of a Middle Eastern potentate. But as was pointed out to me, the value of the car rests in being able to show it. If you've just got to hide it in a darkened garage, cellar, it seems a bit pointless to me. If you can't show a show pony, then what's the point of having a show pony, really?
I'm back in the office now. Let me put my gun away.
Mark Burton is finishing up our tour of the Armamax Gadget Car Factory. His cars are not show ponies. The added value he brings, the bulletproofing, the secret weapons, are all designed to stay hidden until they are needed. But he says Q's Goldfinger DB5 is still an influence on his customers' requests, from heads of state to VIPs and billionaires.
That definitely had an influence on what they wanted, and they don't admit it outright. They won't come out and say, I saw him in the movie Goldfinger. Can I get something like that? They'll just subtly mention it.
Say, for example, you did have a vintage Aston Martin DB5 to hand, and say you were interested in taking it on a genuine mission on Her Majesty's Secret Service. What would it take to add real functioning gadgets to the most famous car in the world?
It can be done. I have the vision in my mind of the DB5. I know the car very well. It would take us about 90 days. You'd be up towards 90,000 on that vehicle. Not including the vehicle.
$90,000? Sounds like a bargain, Q. Next time on The Great James Bond Car Robbery.
You just hotwired it and you just drove it away. It was about that easy.
I still would like to think that some truly obsessive collector stole it just to keep it in his private lair.
And I had to say to them, well, no one goes on a booze cruise in a shipping container.
How did this car find its way into a storage unit at the end of Long Island?
One of the thieves just said, you know what, this car is too beautiful to destroy.
You never know who within your inner circle is eventually going to come forward and say, I know where this car is.
That's all in episode 8. The Great James Bond Car Robbery is brought to you by the Spyscape Podcast Network. The producers are Cup and Nuzzle. Disclaimer: The Great James Bond Car Robbery is not affiliated with Eon Productions, Metro-Goldwyn-Mayer Studios, Inc., or Danjack, LLC.
Do you have what it takes to be a true spy? Now you can put your spy skills to the test with Spy Games. Spy Games is the thrilling new experience at Spyscape in New York. Test your strategy, agility, and teamwork in high-tech game rooms developed with experts from CIA and Special Ops to stretch your physical and mental agility. Inspired by the CIA's operational training at the farm, Spy Games will help you develop strengths you didn't know you had. Think true spies in real life. Find out more at spygames.com.